Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On the theory that things have to hit bottom before they get better, allow me to introduce this morning's GDP number. The economy shrank at a rate of more than 6% in the first quarter. Bad, to be sure, but also just a little bit good. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor. Online at finrafoundation.org. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you with us on this Wednesday. It is the 29th of April today, and the word of the day on this Wednesday is unchanged. That's the headline from the Federal Reserve. After 2 days of talking about it, the Fed is going to leave its federal funds rate steady at 0.25%. The other thing that was essentially unchanged today was the rate at which the economy is contracting. Gross domestic product shrank at a rate of 6.1% in the first quarter. It's right in line with where things were at the end of last year. And it sounds pretty bad, I know. But as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York, investors who dug a little deeper into the data are seeing some promise.
Healthy economies are supposed to grow, and this makes three straight quarters of shrinkage. So what on earth could make a 6.1% drop in the size of the U.S. economy sound hopeful? I asked Guy Labat, chief fixed income strategist at Janney Montgomery Scott.
I think the most notable one is really that consumer spending was remarkably robust. It was up 2.2% on the quarter. And for a quarter when people are screaming about, you know, lack of auto purchases, a lack of appliance purchases, it's really pretty remarkable.
Consumer spending makes up 70% of gross domestic product, after all, and it's a sign of overall confidence, which, as FDR said, is essential. But then how could the economy be shrinking? Here's economist Josh Bivens at the Economic Policy Institute.
What stands out is just the complete collapse of every category of private investment.
For instance, investment in housing fell by 38%. Business spending on everything from equipment to software to buildings fell by a similar amount. On the other hand, the amount of inventory at U.S. companies fell as well, catching up with consumer demand, which may be good in the long term. What does Bivens think about that hopeful consumer spending number?
If it was a trend, I think it might be a good thing. I'm a little dubious that it's a trend.
He says that's because the personal savings rate is still climbing. So if we have any hope of a better GDP number next quarter, Bivens says it'll be because of government spending when that stimulus package finally kicks in. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
This afternoon, the World Health Organization raised its alert level for swine flu to 5 out of possible 6. That is one step short of a full pandemic, although WHO officials said they believe it's only a matter of time before there is a global outbreak of this disease. There are still a lot of unknowns about how this whole thing is going to play out, but as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, it couldn't have come at a worse time for the global economy.
Environmental consultant Eric Norgarten should be in Mexico next week.
We're halting all travel right now because of the epidemic.
Norgarten, who's based in Minneapolis, is knee-deep in a project to install wastewater treatment systems across the Mexican state of Chiapas.
It's better to do business face-to-face in countries like Mexico, but I can get a certain amount of things done. The manufacturing partner that I'm working with on this is in Nevada.
And now you can quickly see where this is going. The Nevada manufacturer may have to push off delivery and payment until the epidemic runs its course, so trade will slow, so will travel. Nancy Parrott of the Azumano Travel Agency in Portland is bracing for that.
People right now are just being a little cautious and taking a wait-and-see attitude.
Parrott says there haven't been many cancellations of business or vacation travel yet, though cruise bookings might fall off as ships are rerouted away from Mexico. The bigger impact, she says, will be if swine flu spreads and Japanese tourism falls off this summer. That's what happened with SARS. Faribor's Gadar is director of the Center for Global Business Studies at Penn State. He says things could get really rough if people other than travelers start staying home.
If it continues to expand in the economy, and the factory workers get sick or the factory workers get scared and don't go to work, then production goes down.
Gadar says a global production slowdown might not make that much difference with the world economy already so weak. That's as long as the epidemic doesn't last too long. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Pork producers know something about managing their image. The ad campaign for The Other White Meat is legendary for its success in convincing consumers that pork, once seen as a fast track to a heart attack, is actually healthier than some other meats. The U.S. hog industry sold 110 million pigs last year. Pork exports to some countries reached record highs. But a deadly virus with the name swine flu? That's a whole lot of damage control. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
Here's what pork producers want you to know.
Pork is safe. This virus is not a foodborne illness, and it is not in the U.S. pig herd.
That's Dave Warner with the National Pork Producers Council. The group's been pushing officials to stop using the term swine flu and call the strain by its scientific name, the H1N1 virus. There have been reports that H1N1 originated in a factory farm in Mexico, where thousands of pigs are born and raised in confined quarters. But Warner says there's no evidence of that.
The first case is from a town where a pork operation does exist, but there is no connection from that pork farm to that person who contracted it.
But convincing the public could be a hard sell. 13 countries, including China and Russia, have already banned some U.S. pork imports. Even small pig farmers think there might be a connection. Lee Minas is a farmer in North Carolina.
The confinement animals are in close quarters, just like the kids in a big school building. So if one of them gets sick, it passes from one to the other really quickly.
Pork futures have been falling since the outbreak, but Minas says the virus could actually increase pork sales at local farmers' markets.
We can tell our customers, you know, you can't fry pork chop and get the pig flu.
The National Pork Board spends about $10 million annually on consumer outreach. That amount may have to be higher this year. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
There was plenty of spending on Wall Street today as traders chose to look on the bright side of that GDP report. We will have the details when we do the numbers. You could say it's been a bit more than 3 months. You could say 14 weeks or so. But somehow 100 days has become the convention. The president has been in office that long today. And commentator David Frum points out there is still a long way to go.
The original 100 days ended with Waterloo, so it's a low bar to do better than that. In his first 100 days, President Obama has done a great deal to restore public optimism and confidence at home. Half of Americans now say the country is on the right track. The best number since the liberation of Baghdad in April 2003. Optimism matters, but it's not very tangible, nor is it likely to be very enduring in the absence of more solid achievements. And here, President Obama's record is more troubling. The restoration of confidence may remind some of Ronald Reagan's Morning in America. But except for a blip after John Hinckley's assassination attempt, Ronald Reagan's job approval numbers only exceeded 60% after his policies had gone into effect and delivered results in 1984, 1985, and 1986. With President Obama at 69%, it seems to be reward first, achievement later, if ever. The United States is racked by the worst financial crisis in decades. Experts estimate the bad debt in the economy at anywhere from $1.5 trillion to $3.5 trillion. President Obama's economic plans are all based on the assumption that the correct figure is at the low end of that range. That's the assumption that lies behind every one of his key economic decisions, from the $800 billion in stimulus to his plans to proceed fast with a big new health care program and cap and trade for carbon emissions. If the president is right, then the United States can probably afford his plans. Just. If he's lowballed it, then the United States will find itself a year or two from now seeking to borrow another trillion on top of debt levels that have already hit peacetime highs. The most important of his decisions are already locked in, and the others are just minutes away. President Obama promised dramatic change, but in one way, he follows so many of his recent predecessors. At this day 100, he has gambled his presidency on his affair with that always popular Washington Belle, Rosie Scenario.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Please take a minute to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. As President Obama gets to work on the remaining 1,360 days of his term, he's probably not thinking much about what happens after he leaves office. And really, he's not going to have much to worry about financially anyway. He'll have to raise money for his library, that's about it. Otherwise, he'll have a pension, an office, and a staff, as well as an expense account. Wasn't always that way for former chief executives, though. Our former colleague here at Marketplace, Matthew Algio, has a new book out about one key event in Harry Truman's post-presidency. It's a book called Harry Truman's Excellent Adventure.
In the summer of 1953, right after he left office, he decided to take a long car trip. And he loved cars, he loved traveling, and so he and Bess packed the Chrysler with 11 suitcases and drove from their home in Independence, Missouri to the East Coast and back. 19 days, 2,500 miles, no Secret Service, nobody, no attendants, nothing. They just went by themselves.
Do me a favor and set the scene. Put us in a car in 1953 on a road trip like this. What was it like?
Well, it was pretty hot. That's one thing. There was a primitive form of air conditioning. Harry's car didn't have it. Harry never really believed in air conditioning. You wouldn't see many superhighways at the time. There were no interstates. You would have spent a lot of time eating at roadside diners. You wouldn't see any McDonald's. You wouldn't see any motel chains either. It took you longer to get from A to B in 1953 than it does today.
When he left the White House, what was Harry Truman's bank balance? I mean, he was not a rich guy with a cushion to sit on, was he?
What his bank balance was when he left the White House, nobody really knows. When it came to talking about money, Harry Truman didn't like to talk about it. It is known, however, that he took out a loan from a Washington bank shortly before he left office. And then in early 1958, he had to sell his family's farm in Grandview, Missouri, to help make ends meet. So clearly in that period, 53 to 58, there were some financial issues in the Truman household.
What about pensions? I mean, he was president for almost 8 years. He was in the Senate for a while. Didn't he get a government pension, too?
No. He had very unfortunate timing, really, because he left the Senate in 1945, and the Senate did not begin receiving pensions until 1946. So he missed out on that. And ex-presidents at the time did not receive a pension. So his only income actually was $111.96 a month. That's what he got for his Army service during World War I. Ironically, his almost 8 years as commander-in-chief didn't count as credit toward that pension. So that was his only income.
Did his condition, did the fact that he didn't have very much when he left the White House influence the way ex-presidents are treated today?
In one respect, for sure. In 1958, after word got out that he had had to sell the family farm, Congress finally passed a Presidential Pension Act, pensions of $25,000 a year to ex-presidents, as well as office expenses and postage. Now ex-presidents get about $190,000 a year, plus pretty much unlimited expenses.
And whatever they decide to accept for speaking fees and membership on corporate boards and all that.
Yeah, yeah. That really changed with Gerald Ford. He was the first ex-president to make use of his name. And since then, that's kind of been the standard. Big speaking fees, big book deals. Harry had a book deal, but it didn't turn out to make him very much money. But he didn't want to do anything that would, he called it commercializing the presidency. He didn't even take speaking fees beyond an honorarium. I remember when the Clintons released their income tax returns, and Bill Clinton had made millions in speaking fees since leaving office. And Leon Panetta said, "We've come a long way since Harry Truman."
Matthew Algio used to work here. He writes books now. His most recent is called Harry Truman's Excellent Adventure, the true story of a great American road trip. Matthew, thanks a bunch.
Oh, you're welcome, Guy.
Coming up, entrepreneurship in Mexico is not for the timid.
Do these look like pretty hands with painted fingernails? No, you see the hands of a working woman. And people in our town need that paper so we can keep working.
But first, let's do the numbers. Growth in consumer spending and no change on interest rates helped drive the Dow. Industrials up 168 points today, 2.1%. Finished the day at 8,185. The blue chips did. The Nasdaq jumped 38 points, about 2.25%. closed at 1711. The S&P 500 climbed 18 points, about 2.2%, ended at 873. Shareholders of Bank of America may be sour on CEO Ken Lewis, but investors weren't. Despite all the harsh words for Lewis at today's annual shareholder meeting down in Charlotte, North Carolina, B of A stock finished 6.5% higher. Shares of Citigroup rose 2.75%. Positive earnings also lifted the markets. Defense contractor General Dynamics advanced more than 5.33% on news. First quarter earnings were up. Better than expected results from Time Warner boosted shares of the media giant nearly 1%. Investors were in a good mood in Europe today, too. Germany's DAX, the British FTSE, and France's CAC 40 all closed up more than 2%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.1%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. Ever wonder what it takes to make an asset toxic? Check out the Marketplace Whiteboard on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for March. A House committee holds a hearing on combating maritime piracy. And 220 years ago, on April 30th, 1789, George Washington took his oath of office as the nation's first president. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The pieces that might keep Chrysler out of bankruptcy are slowly falling into place. The company has convinced its biggest creditors to take billions less than they're owed. It has reached tentative agreements with the United Auto Workers Union. And there are reports this afternoon that a deal to partner up with Fiat is all but signed on the dotted line. All of that might come to naught, though, if Chrysler can't figure out how to get rid of some of its 3,200 dealerships, as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Now that Chrysler's downsizing, it has to downsize dealerships, too. The dealers are fighting that, but
they are the least strong of the partners in this emerging deal.
Jim Cashman teaches management at the University of Alabama.
And so it looks to me as though there are going to be hundreds of dealers put out of business.
Regardless of whether Chrysler and Fiat link up. State franchise laws protect many dealers from a shutdown without some assistance from car makers. The problem is, if Chrysler goes bankrupt, that could trump those state laws. Quite often, the dealerships pay for the cars on their lots with loans, and they'd be stuck holding the bag. Chuck Eddy has about 500 new cars at his Chrysler dealership in Youngstown, Ohio.
Where can someone show me a business model that says that less dealers makes the supplier healthy? You need sales.
And bankruptcy doesn't exactly help sell cars. If dealers go out of business, Eddie says many communities across the country could lose a major source of revenue.
In some small townships, when a car dealership is the largest tax collector and largest tax base, it could shut a township down. You could lose police and fire service.
Fewer dealerships also means fewer TV ads, fewer donations to charities and religious groups, not to mention less money for local Little League teams. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
The global economy is about more than big conglomerates and multinationals. When you boil it all down, it's about a single person doing a job and trying to get by. Today on our series, Working, how our electronic waste is someone else's treasure. The EPA says only 18% of the used electronics in this country are recycled, but manufacturers are mining that e-waste for raw materials that can be reused. One woman in northern Mexico looked across the border at our growing pile of electronic rejects, and she saw an opportunity for herself and her town. Ingrid Lobet has our profile.
Vicky Ponce stands in front of a mountain of shattered TV carcasses and pries a big piece of copper off the back of a picture tube.
Llegó el momento de la verdad.
The moment of truth.
Each day, Vicky bends over this workbench with a small group of women and dismantles TVs and computers collected across southern Arizona.
La compañera ya trajo esta televisión.
My friend is taking apart this TV. The first screws you take out are on the top.
Getting this job was a major struggle, but Vicky says it's not like life had been easy before. For 4 years, she and her husband had no steady work.
We were selling tamales on the streets. Sometimes we even crossed the border to clean houses.
There just aren't that many jobs here in Fronteras, 45 minutes south of the Arizona border. And what jobs there are, says Vicky's friend Lydia Barreda, don't go to women like them in their 50s and 60s.
Here in Mexico, there's a lot of discrimination against people who are older. After the age of 35, it's hard to get a job. It's not like in the United States, where older people keep on working.
So hard up and fed up, 3 years ago, Vicky and several other women here vowed to figure out how to bring more jobs to Fronteras. And they called on a friend with connections in the U.S., a local rancher named Alice Valenzuela. They asked her to help.
Everybody said the women's cooperative would never make it. We had no money and no contacts, so we would never find a building in which to put a business. We would never find an investor who would want to come to a town with dirt streets and no infrastructure.
But soon Alice Valenzuela made a contact, the owner of a Vermont recycling company called RetroWorks. The company was looking to expand and agreed to do it here in Fronteras. So the women traveled to Vermont and learned the e-waste business. Now Vicky can give the name and value of every part of a computer.
Estas contienen mucho oro.
We sort these parts into different barrels. They each contain different metals. These right here contain a lot of gold. We send these to Malaysia.
Thanks to contacts they got from RetroWorks Vermont, the Mexico startup now sells parts to Egypt, Malaysia, and Florida. They work out of this huge abandoned warehouse they convinced local officials to lend them. Yet 16 months after they moved in and started taking things apart, there's still no electricity. The mayor told the utility not to turn it on. He's been their biggest foe. Vicky and the others have their suspicions why.
Probably it's because we haven't made any contributions to him. Or it could be that he hates us because we stood up for ourselves.
Vicky and many others here in Fronteras believe their startup would have moved more quickly if they were willing to pay bribes, but they're not. Vicky says she may not have much, but she's got her reputation.
Queremos todo limpio.
We want everything clean. We want to hold our heads up. We don't want people to say we were involved in anything shady.
Paying bribes, she says, would also reinforce a negative view of her country.
Para que los inversionistas...
We want foreign investors to know that we're operating honestly.
Because Vicky has plans. RetroWorks Mexico is still tiny, only 10 employees, but she wants to bring many more jobs here.
Para hacerlo grande.
We want to make it grow big, so there's a job here for anyone who wants to work, so we can all live. Maybe not in luxury, but with dignity.
In the meantime, with no electricity, they press on with hand tools, screwdrivers, pliers, wrenches, and wire cutters.
Porque si fuera con pistola,
oof. If we had an air gun, our hands wouldn't be cramping up.
Vicky says this long fight to get RetroWorks started has made her less timid and less tolerant of the old way of doing business in Mexico, like on her fourth trip to a government office for a customs permit when they told her she'd have to come back a fifth time.
I said, we're not leaving here until you sign that paper. I said, do these look like pretty hands with painted fingernails? No, you see the hands of a working woman, and people in our town need that paper so we can keep working.
Local people call them Las Chicas Bravas, the tough girls. One person who's seen them get tougher is Marco Antonio Armendariz, a legal advocate. On a visit to his office, Vicky and he reminisce about when the chicas first called him for help.
They were terrified. They didn't know their rights.
The mayor of Fronteras was threatening to evict them, saying the building wasn't really theirs.
They didn't know the mayor didn't have the authority to kick them out.
And then he turns to Vicky with a bombshell.
Someone called and offered me $20,000 to tell you that you had no case, that you had to vacate the building and stop pushing.
He speculates the chicas may have fouled up someone's plans to use the building for something illegal, like stashing drugs.
A lo mejor vaya a ser la primera empresa.
Maybe they'll be the first business to ever get started in Mexico without paying a single bribe.
When she's not at work, Vicky is most often at her wood stove, cooking. It's the hearth of the two-bedroom home she shares with her husband, Antonio.
Frijolitos salen más buenos con leñita.
Vicky and Antonio have two grown daughters in Arizona. The girls used to send money home, but now their daughters have both lost their jobs. So Antonio says the parents are helping out their kids in the United States.
The roles are reversed now. Instead of money coming from there to here, it's flowing from here to there.
The small recycling enterprise is so successful that Vicky says one daughter keeps asking when she can return to Fronteras and get a job there.
She says, Mommy, hurry up with the plant. I want to come home and work there.
Nothing, Vicky says, would please her more.
Ingrid Lobet went to Fronteras, Mexico to get that story for us. Our series, Working, is a collaboration with Homelands Productions. We've got pictures of Vicky Ponce and the archive of the whole series on our webpage. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, President Obama has spent most of the past 100 days trying to save the global economy. You?
I quit my job in January as an engineer, but I've been managing my own tax practice. So that's my first big leap to being an entrepreneur.
I have climbed Yosemite Falls.
I stopped partying a lot.
I bought a bike and I've been riding around.
Nothing spectacular, nothing too worth mentioning except I had a baby.
That was DJ Mendoza, Jennifer Westfall, Sandra Lopez, Jorge Garcia, and Mohammed El Aravi here in downtown Los Angeles looking back at their last 100 days. I'm not sure what I did in that time. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow jumped 168 points, more than 2%. The NASDAQ rose 38 points, about 2.25%. The S&P 500 bumped up 18 points, about 2.2%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, Wilco covers Woody Guthrie.
To answer your question, what would Woody write about now? Everything.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.